The court will proceed to the fifth case, the United States versus Colon. Mr. Mormon.
May it please the court and counsel, when I was appointed to this case, Chris Colon, the defendant, had already pled guilty to the charge and was anticipating a sentence of 70 months pursuant to a plea agreement and what was discussed in the courtroom. After he pled, the Supreme Court decided the Blakely case, which gave a lot of optimism to defendants, thinking that maybe they wouldn't be bound by some of these guidelines. By the time I had concluded my representation of him at the trial, he had a sentence of 121 months. And that was based on three things. One, that when we got to the sentencing hearing, in the pre-sentence investigation, a fact was asserted that was not one of the facts alleged and not one of the facts in the stipulation of facts, that when he was arrested he had a dangerous weapon, which is a thing called a punch dagger. And I argued that under the Booker case, the court did not have the authority to look into this matter of this weapon. But I lost that ruling. The court did look into that, found that that was a dangerous weapon, and that two additional offense levels should be put in there. That added time to what the sentence was. Then the court went on to notice that he had, it's not much of a record, but it was enough. He had a prior record of disorderly conduct, and he had been put on not suspended sentence, but conditional discharge. And because of a case called Caputo, you can call that probation, so he'd committed this offense while he was on probation. That added more. The prosecution, the government, had agreed at the time of the sentencing that he should get points for having a minor role, but the judge suggested otherwise, and at the sentencing the prosecution changed its mind and said, well, now we agree. So those three things added to this sentence, really well over 4 years, to what was anticipated.
Well, here's the problem. Yeah. I have. I don't understand how the government could breach the agreement when it expressly allows for the government to provide arguments supporting the court's findings as to offense level.
Well, that's right. There is the provision, I'd say, in the fine print, there is a provision. We're making this agreement. I mean, we are saying in the plea agreement that we agree that you are entitled to points for minor role,
right,
which will reduce your sentence. But there is a paragraph down there at the end that says, well, this is all preliminary, and although we're saying what we agree, when the time comes, we don't have to agree.
Well, it said that it would allow the government to make arguments supporting the sentencing court's findings. And so with respect to that, wasn't that the position the government was really, I mean, it was kind of vague in terms of the language, but wasn't that really the intent of the government at that time?
Well, apparently it was. I mean, they did have to change their mind,
right,
to do it. They did say at the time of the plea agreement, and it was put into the plea agreement, what their position was. Then the judge suggested otherwise, and when the time came, they said, yes, we agree with the judge that he's not entitled to these points for minor role. And that, of course, is the way the judge ruled.
Well, yeah, because the government said, as far as the court's prior rulings in this case, I think it's consistent with the court's leanings today of not giving a two-point minor role for this defendant. I mean, that language is the language I think the government was offering to support the court's findings.
That's right. That is exactly the quote of what the government said. But, of course, that's inconsistent with what the government had said in its written plea agreement.
But what about the appeal waiver and the plea agreement?
What we said is, if the government can change its mind, can we change our mind? For two reasons. One, because
the plea agreement waives the right to appeal.
That's right.
Any sentence within the statutory maximum, and this is within the statutory.
Yes, it is within the statute.
So why isn't that the end of the case?
It, by its terms, it could well be the end of the case. In this case, two things happened. One, the Supreme Court in the Blakely case raised some questions that were not in the minds of anybody at the time.
You didn't ask to get out of the plea, right?
I'm sorry?
Never a request to back out of the plea agreement.
No, that is true.
And then the plea agreement has an appeal waiver in it, so see how you can get out of the batter's box.
Well, I mean, there's certainly an argument to be made, which has been made, that we can't get out of the batter's box because of that. What I suggested was that in view of the fact that the government was changing its mind, that should give us the prerogative to do so.
Okay.
Yeah. And I think that summarizes our position.
Well, thank you, Mr. Mormon. You reserve the rest of the time for rebuttal.
Thank you.
All right. Mr. Liggins?
Good morning, Your Honors. I was not the attorney of record below, but I will attempt to answer any questions the court might have regarding this matter. With regard to the first two issues that counsel raised regarding the dangerous weapon enhancement and the criminal history computation, the only argument he offered below, and as I understand, the only argument he offers before this court today of why that finding by the court was an error, was the Booker decision. I think it's fairly plain that Booker doesn't apply to this case, that his statutory sentence was not enhanced by these findings, and the judge, if you look at the sentencing hearing, treated the guidelines as advisory. So those enhancements clearly don't present a Booker problem. And if there are no questions from the court on those two issues, I'll move on to the issue that did seem to draw some interest from the court, and that's the alleged government breach of the plea agreement. Now, it would be helpful to this court to know the context in which this arose, because there is a vague reference that the AUSA who handled this case made about the court's prior rulings in this case, and the way this issue arose is that in a previous sentencing hearing of a co-defendant, the government had agreed to recommend a downward departure for minor role with regard to that defendant, the Estelle Flores, I believe was her name. The district court, the same district judge, vigorously objected to that, took umbrage, perhaps it wouldn't be too strong of a word to say that the government was recommending that in that case for that defendant who is connected to this case, and then after that issued his order saying, I note that the government is also recommending a minor role adjustment for Mr. Mormon's client, and the district court said, I'm not going to be inclined to go along with that. Well, once the court said that, I don't believe it was unreasonable for the AUSA handling this case to say, well, I'm going to invoke the provision on page 6 of our plea agreements, which says that the government reserves the right to support whatever findings that the district judge wants to make that might be in opposition to what we've agreed to in this plea agreement. There's a very good reason that we put that provision in plea agreements, and it's to cover this situation where a district judge has strong feelings that the government has just flat got it wrong in its plea agreement. We're not left in the position of telling him, well, you got to do it anyway because we're not going to support you on appeal. It gives us the the option in that situation when the district court feels strongly about an issue to support the finding that that judge decides that he needs to make.
Well, let me get the sequence of events clear for in my mind, Mr. Leggins. The other defendant went first.
That's correct.
And that caused Judge Herndon to have some unease about the agreement.
Yes, that's
right. At least the minor participant.
Yes.
At that point, had the plea agreement with Mr. Colon been in
yes,
place?
Yes, I believe so.
Oh, okay. So that's day one, let's say, whatever that exchange occurred in the co-defendant's case. What time expires between that hearing and the one with Mr. Mormon's client?
I'm not sure how much time expired, but an intervening event was the judge issued the order saying, I don't agree with either probation office's or the government's recommendation in this case.
Yeah, but
that there's
did that
a
occur at the same time as the other plea? Did he take the pleas together? Is that
no? Did he take the pleas together?
Yeah. What I'm driving at is, did there come a point in time when it became apparent to Judge Herndon's view of this case as to minor participant by both people occur, and yet there was the sentencing to occur with Mr. Colon? In other words, did the government once advise that he was not predisposed to give a minor participant view of the case to the other co-defendant? The government now knows that that's not going to be the case for Mr. Colon.
I believe my recollection, and I did not ask the attorney who handled it below that question. My recollection from reading Mr. Colon's PSI is that at the time he had pled, I don't believe the other two had, but I'm not sure about that,
yeah.
Your Honor.
Yeah, my unease in this area is if the government sees that the circumstances surrounding the plea agreement as it was set up with a defendant changes. I understand that your point about reserving what's to be reserved, and I'm not suggesting there's some estoppel here, but I am wondering whether or not the government ought to revisit in its negotiations with the defendant that we have a changed circumstance, because you're not coming into court exactly as the government represented to counsel, I'm sure, at the defendant, you were coming in. Now, I'm not saying there's misconduct at the point of which the judge indicates he's going to rule such and so, and you seek to support the ruling. I understand that. But I just wonder whether or not there's any blindsiding of a sort that occurs. I mean, you knew of the weapon, right? I mean, there's no new information that comes out that you're supporting.
Correct. We knew.
Know this judge is going to change his attitude
on
Mr. Colon's case because you know it from the co-defendant's case.
If that happened,
Well, I don't know. If you don't know, I can't certainly hold you to account for that.
I don't know, but I would agree with the court that if that type of sandbagging occurred, it would be improper.
Well, I mean, at least it might impact the thinking of seeking to withdraw the plea. I don't know. I mean, you know, every case is different, obviously. But you can see where my unease is.
I not only concede it, I would concede the point that if that occurred, that would be a problem. And I would be happy to get back to the court on that very question if the court desires.
If you wish to submit something in that regard, you may have 10 days to do so. And Mr. Mormon, you may have 5 days if you wish to submit a counter affidavit to that.
I appreciate that, Your Honor. And if there are no further questions, that's all I have on that issue.
Thank you, Mr. Leggins.
Thank you.
Mr. Mormon? Can you shed any light on the inquiry I'm trying to establish here?
Some. When the judge changed his mind after Colon had entered his plea of guilty, the judge changed his mind on this matter of minor role, we were notified of that. So we knew the judge had changed his mind.
I understand.
We didn't know that the government had changed its mind, But the judge did notify the parties.
Well, what exactly, when you say the government changed its mind, tell me what you mean by that.
The government agreed in its plea agreement that Chris Colon was entitled to credit for minor role.
Right. Well, so they come to court. They don't change their mind. The judge, independently of them, gives his assessment of the case, and they are then obliged, as the government would say, to support. I mean, is it a change of mind, or are they just acknowledging that the judge is going down this path, and the evidence there is in the record to support his conclusions?
Well, they, in their plea agreement, they said that it was their position he was entitled to minor role. Now, the judge did send out a notice after this happened in this other case. I mean, it's a co-defendant, but it was a separate proceeding.
See, the thing that this language that I keep getting back to, what the government says as far as the court's prior rulings in this case, referring to the other case, where the people got minor, right? They did not.
Actually, it was the other way around.
They got they did not get minor.
That's right. I understand
it. But he's saying that, you know, his ruling, he says, as far as the prior rulings in this case, I think it's consistent with the court's leanings today of not giving a two-point minor role for this defendant. So the government is commenting, you know, the other two didn't get minor. And it's consistent that the court is not giving minor here. And that's sort of the position the government is taking. I mean,
It is the
and
position.
And I understand you're saying that then means that they're objecting. I mean, they're not saying, you know, they're not arguing he should get the minor role.
Yes. I think that the government argued that this other defendant should not get the minor. The defense lawyer argued at sentencing, well, we're as entitled to the minor as this other one. You're saying he's entitled to minor. We ought to get minor. The judge said, no, I don't think you ought to. And come to think of it, I don't think the other guy should get minor as well. That, in a sense, he said, you're right. They're both in the same, they're in the same boat, and I don't think either one of them are entitled to it.
Now, to Judge Evans' inquiry, Mr. Mormon, with that notice, should counsel call upon the court to ask time to reconsider the plea, perhaps withdrawing the plea?
Could be. Mm-hmm. Could be. That's not what we did.
No, I understand. Mm-hmm. I understand.
Right.
What, before you sit down, what happened to this? You filed a motion to dismiss this appeal.
That's right.
And what happened to that?
Well, we filed the motion. It was my understanding that that's what the defendant wanted me to do.
Yeah, that's what it says.
Because there,
instructed you to file the motion to dismiss the appeal.
There was some talk with the prosecution about providing some information and maybe getting some advantage as a result of doing that. That's what I thought the defendant wanted me to do. I did it, but the court said we're not going to grant that unless he'll sign off, and he never would sign off.
Thank you, Mr. Mormon.
Thank you.
Thanks, Legan. Mr. Mormon, you have an additional thanks to the court for accepting this appointment.
Thank you.
All right, the case is taken under advisement. And